Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Common Ground, where we explore the liturgical calendar as a spiritual practice. I'm your host, Karen Peter, and our guest today is Christy Scoresmith. Hi, Christy.
Hi, nice to be with you today.
Now, Christy lives in the Seattle, Washington area, and I would like to ask you to just share a little bit about yourself so the listeners get to know you a little bit before we dive into our topic this morning.
Okay, well, it's great to be with you today. I'm really enjoying the opportunity to share. I grew up in the Reorganized Church and now the Community of Christ Church, four generations on both sides, so very steeped in the history of the reorganization. I am married. I have three children, a nine-year-old and twins that are seven. I work for a business that manufactures medical suits for children that have disabilities like autism and cerebral palsy. I do lots of international traveling for my job. And I've also been able to, over the years, work for the church all over the world. So I have a real kind of global perspective, I feel like, about our movement. I've been able to volunteer at various church historic sites and work for the church in different countries as well. I'm an elder in the church, and I am very active in my community and congregation. I play the flute at church and sing sometimes. So I enjoy very much being a part of the Community of Christ Church.
Absolutely.
I also love history. So I'm excited to talk today about some of the historical parts of our movement as well. I also have a real passion about women's studies. I did my master's program on women's leadership and roles with a focus on women leaders in our church. So that's a real big passion for me as well. So that's a little bit about me.
And in our conversations via email before our interview today, you have a master's in peace studies, which is a focus of Community of Christ. So today we're going to talk a little bit about an important kind of almost iconic figure in Restoration history. And you did some research on this person, and we're going to talk about it in the framework of All Saints Day, which is November 1st. So if you've listened to Common Grounds for the past year, we went through the Christian calendar and we learned a little bit about All Saints Day when we remember the figures that have influenced the Christian community, our denomination, even our own personal discipleship. And we reflect on those individuals and groups of people on All Saints Day. And so our figure today is Emma Smith, and you did some particular work and studying about Emma, and it's a good day to talk about her on All Saints Day. She's the probably all-time favorite, quote, saint, unquote, of Community of Christ. So let's start with growing up in the RLDS Church and then Community of Christ. What did you know about Emma Smith, just from kind of growing up in that, in our tradition?
Great question. So some of your audience might not realize that there were some books that were written about Emma Smith in our movement. Some were novels. There was this real famous novel written in the 1950s, I think 54, called Emma Smith, an Elect Lady. And I remember my grandfather had a copy of that book, and when he studied about Emma, he passed that love of studying about Emma onto my dad, and my dad also passed that passion. So growing up in the church, we had this story of Emma that was really passed down through the ages, and there were some themes that were that story, and one of those was that Emma was, we were the church of Emma. I think I don't know how many times I heard that phrase. We are Emma's church. We are the church of Emma. So there was this real sense that the LDS church was the church of Brigham Young and some of Joseph's later Tippecanoe period. And we were the church of Emma and more of the Kirtland period. And And it was really preserved, I think, through her and her teachings with her children, some of the original Kirtland teachings. And one of the things that was really kind of ground into me as a child was that Emma publicly always really denied that Joseph was a polygamist. I know privately they really struggled with that, but she really taught that to her children. She really focused on that publicly. She was really working against it with the Women's Relief Society and some of her work there. And so that kind of became one of the backgrounds in our movement, was this denial of Joseph's polygamous history. But that really came from Emma. And so I remember even at church as a little, I mean, it must have been either elementary school or junior high school. And I remember hearing elders in my congregation adamantly denying that Joseph was a polygamist, because look at his wife. His wife said, you know, he was not a polygamist. And they really turned to Emma as like this model for that myth we were telling ourselves. Mm-hmm. Another thing I really remember is that we really didn't talk about her marriage after Joseph died to Major Biteman. We really didn't talk about that. In fact, I really didn't know much about that until I went to Nauvoo as a tour guide later in college. And I remember I was shocked to find out, oh, she remarried. And I went back and was re-looking at some of the histories that were written in the early reorganization, like in the 1890s and stuff, by some of the prominent church leaders. And they would talk about Emma's life up until Joseph died. And then they talked about her children after that, but they really didn't focus a lot on Biteman. So that was part of our story too, was that Emma was Joseph's wife. You know, we really didn't focus on her later years, which is interesting because those later years are really what formed our movement too. Mostly, you know, I know another part of our story is that she really participated in the Methodist church after Joseph's death. She would play the piano there and she would sing hymns there. And so a lot of our reorganized, sort of practices and stuff from later on mimic some of that Methodist, practice, because that's what her children grew up doing and going through. And I remember that was I remember hearing a lot about how we're very similar to the Methodists and we're trying to make this real big distinction between us and the LDS church by clinging to this Methodist period in Emma's life, which was really important. I think the other thing I remember from childhood is this very strong image we had of her and her children crossing Mississippi, the frozen Mississippi, to get to the other side when the mob was chasing her. And Joseph had been, you know, he was fleeing and he had left in a different part. I don't know where he was, but she had, her daughter Julia was on one side and her, Joseph the third was on the other side clinging to her dress. And she had two babies, one in each arm, and she was crossing the frozen, Mississippi. And we have clung to this image of Emma. And it's interesting because in that image, Joseph Smith Jr. is not there. You know, it's Emma. She's the strong woman and the children. There's this very, clear picture of her with the children and going through hardship and fleeing and this sort of pioneer tenacity. So that's also something I really remember from my childhood, is this view of her. The other thing I remember too that was a little bit more influential to me as I was older, but and we'll talk more about this later, I'm sure, but with her, the revelation, direct lady revelation that was given to Joseph about Emma and her role in the church, even using the word ordained, you know, these things. And I remember us looking to that as a precursor to the women in our movement who were eventually able to be ordained. So that, I feel like as a young person, that message was clearly given to me too, that see, Emma from the beginning, from 1830, she was here, as an ordained woman in our movement was the subtle and clear message as well, actually. So anyway, those are some of the things I remember from my childhood.
So many of our listeners, many of our female listeners in particular, are interested in how Community of Christ folks kind of in general view Emma. Do you think some of the things that you've shared, these iconic images of Emma, do you think that's kind of the standard perspective of Emma for people in Community of Christ?
I I think so. I mean, I grew up in Seattle, which is a pretty progressive city even at the time, and it's still pretty liberal. And I was surrounded by very liberal thinkers in our church. So sometimes I'm not sure if my experience as a child was because of my geographic location in the church. I do know, having worked in the church in Africa and Central America and in Europe, that other global parts of the church are not as focused on U.S. history and that part of our history as we are here in the U.S. So I think globally, that story is really not told. And that makes sense because it doesn't really speak to their context. And I think nationally, I think what's told, you know, is that she's ours. You know, she belongs to us. She's the matriarch of our church. She didn't go with Brigham Young, when he left. And I think we tell ourselves the story about how she chose to stay. And there was this kind of this contention between her and Brigham Young. And that she, because of her choices, she formed the theology, really, of what became Joseph Smith III's theology. Mm-hmm. And I think that, that's the story that probably the U.S. church tells ourselves is, and I believe that. I believe that too. She kind of edited the story that she lived through and gave this edited version to her children, who were very young. I mean, Julie was only 13 and Joseph Smith Jr. was 12 when their dad died. So they were still quite young. I also don't think that the vast majority of the U.S. church really understands, or the global church as well, but doesn't understand how strong and independent and opinionated she was, and how much she pushed back publicly, privately for sure, but also publicly with Joseph Smith, and that she had this real passion and devotion for Joseph. But she also wouldn't let it go too far. And she really was adamant about, we can talk about those too, but I don't think we tell ourselves that, and how competent she was, and that she ran the family farm and she ran the mansion house, and she nursed the people during malaria outbreaks and cholera outbreaks. And I mean, you know, she would make homemade remedies, salves, and there's recipes that she shared about different salves to put on people and for different things. So she was kind of this, you know, medicine woman or whatever, but she was working yeah. on so many different things. And she was this amazingly skilled and smart woman. She was extremely well read, and she, you know, she wrote music and she played the piano, and there's this whole depth of her, this she's sort of this Renaissance pioneer woman, mm-hmm. Probably because she had to be. Many women were back then. But we don't tell each other that story. We tell each other this story that she was a devoted wife and she was a loving mother, which she was, both those things. And we sort of elevate some of the church work that she did, but we don't necessarily focus on the fact that she was a businesswoman and she had to run the farm and she had to run the mansion house and she had to negotiate property deals when Joseph was gone. And, you know, there's this whole other side of her that really was powerful and strong and smart and educated that we don't hear that story. That's some of what I learned in my research.
So why did you choose to research Emma in your studies?
Well, I really became fascinated with her when I was a tour guide, first in Nauvoo and then later in Kirtland. And I learned some of these stories about her, a couple that I've shared, they were shocking to me as a young, you know, 20 something year old woman finding her way in the world, realizing that Emma had really done some amazing things that I didn't know about growing up hearing about her. Here she's sort of this elevated person and this matriarch for our religious tradition, but I didn't know how spunky she was and how interesting and opinionated she was. One of my favorite stories I learned when I was in Nauvoo was about how one time she was on a trip and she came back and Joseph had built a bar in their mansion house, and she was just livid about this, that he had done this. First of all, because she had to clean up. I mean, the men were spitting their tobacco all over the floor, and they were having drunken parties and spilling stuff and knocking stuff over and just creating all this headache that she had to clean up later. But also because of just what it represented in her home, and that her children, they were living on the second floor. They had some small private rooms that were just for the family to use. And then the bottom floor was kind of public space. And then there were some rooms upstairs that people rented. But her children were right upstairs, you know, sleeping when this stuff was happening. And she was just livid. And she said to him, either that bar goes or I and the children will move out. We will move out. And so he took it out. You know, which that shocked me. I thought, as a 20-something year old, I just thought, wow, you know, he's so gutsy and bold at the time when, you know, women were not seen as quite equals with men. I loved that story, and I thought, I need to learn more about her. And then there's also a story, you know, that was just kind of really interesting to me that circulated around for a while. Again, I'm not sure, the origins of it. Perhaps you know, or someone knows that's listening, but there was a school teacher, Eliza Snow, that was teaching some of the children, and she ended up moving into the Mansion House for a while and watching over some of the kids and tutoring the children. And that there was rumors circulating, as there were a lot, that there was a relationship between Joseph and Eliza Snow. And I remember when I was at Nauvoo, there was a story about how at one point, Emma pushed Eliza Snow down some stairs in the Mansion House. And people used to say on the tours, here's the stairs that Emma pushed Eliza Snow down. And I thought, what are you telling me? You know, like, this woman, is this true? What does this mean about this woman? If it is, why did this happen? Is that a weird interpretation? Is that, you know, just so many questions about that. But this is a story that is part of our history, that she was upset with Eliza Snow and pushed her down the stairs. And I thought, what is going on? I have to learn more about her. You know, what kind of person was she? And did she really do this? And what was the circumstances behind that? And why would there be these rumors? And so just some interesting stories I remember hearing. My thesis, as I mentioned before, was on women leaders in the Community of Christ, and I interviewed 16 women leaders that were top leaders in our church at the time. And what I wanted to do with my study was also go back and show different periods in our church and the women leaders that had been the strong leaders at different periods. So I picked Emma as my first strong woman at the very beginning of the movement to research and study. And then two other women later. And so that was kind of the reason why it started my curiosity with these crazy stories that sort of shattered my view of her as this sort of pious, devout church lady that played hymns and, you know, lovingly, which she did, took care of her children. But, you know, that was kind of it from my childhood. And, mm-hmm. and so these other stories of this fiery, independent woman, true or not, I didn't even know. I'm like, I have to learn more about her.
Yeah.
So that's how that happened.
So the very depth of her character and the multifaceted aspects of who she was are so different than just kind of the legendary story that gets passed down
with these
kind of iconic moments of who she was as kind of matriarch of church. And you mentioned a couple that I think are really important for us to maybe talk about a little bit, because they're not fleshed out kind of in the legendary story that Community of Christ people would have grown up mm-hmm. with. And so the first one is that she was ordained she was the elect lady. She was ordained as a leader, as a minister. You mentioned kind of medicine woman. I think more like shaman sometimes when I mm-hmm. think mm-hmm. about the different things mm-hmm. that she did and the different roles that she played. But she mm-hmm. obviously, Joseph respected her ministry. So let's talk a little bit about that, what you discovered there.
Yeah. You know, the elect lady, revelation is the only one in our church that is specifically given to just one woman. And for that alone, it's such a wonderful document. And it says to her that you are ordained to expound scripture and to exhort the church. And those are ministerial roles that men had in our church up until this point. And what I find fascinating about the relationship between Joseph and Emma is that private things that happened between them came out later in scripture and in his preaching, and then also in revelations, his revelations. And this is a perfect example of that. Emma was doing all of these things. She was healing, you know, people through her presence, but also her salves that she would make. She was writing, she was the scribe to him for a lot of the writing of the Book of Mormon, which tells me how highly educated she was and that he needed assistance in that area. She was probably more educated than him, is what that tells me. And that, you know, she was also, this revelation, that she was to exhort the church, you know, really focus on, bringing forth the ongoing mission of the church. And also in this revelation, she was given the task of creating a hymnal for the church to use. And the hymnal, we've just been through this big hymnal project in our church right now. And the hymnal for us is one of our most concrete public ways that we share our theology, you know, and for her to be given the task of compiling what songs are we going to be singing and what message are we going to be telling each other, that is a huge responsibility. So these things that she was given in this revelation were not light. They were not small things. They were big deals. And I find it so fascinating that this happened. And we as a movement, I think this has been a touchstone for us, you know, in 1984 with the ordination of women in our movement. We have pulled on this tradition and said, you know, Emma from the beginning, she was ordained and elected as this female figure in our movement, and we can build on that. Now, it took us, you know, 150 years or whatever, to make that global, which is unfortunate. But we tell ourselves that we have these threads, you know, and we can go back and say, look, you know, we were doing it. We were trying. And I wonder, you know, without the Masonic influence of Nauvoo and that period and stuff, I really wonder back in that Kirtland period, which we hearkened back to with the restoration, what would have happened with women in our movement if we had really teased out that thread and really focused on that and not the complete opposite where we ended up, in my opinion. I get pretty passionate about that, in Nauvoo, which is, you know, complete control over women's bodies and, you know, the opposite of free choice and, you know, really going to some dark places. And that very beginning period, you know, there were these glimmers of freedom for women that was not even experienced on a national level, certainly not a global level, but national level at the time. And where could we have gone with that, you know, had we really been brave enough to do that? I really wonder that.
So by the time we do get to the Nauvoo period, we enter a really volatile time in Emma mm-hmm. and Joseph's relationship.
Yes.
Where he, because of choices he had made, but also because of the influence of the kind of men in his circle that he trusted, they mm-hmm. were constantly mm-hmm. Kind of trying to get him to control her in various ways,
yep.
including
right. Absolutely.
Through the use of in what we would now call inspired counsel or revelation.
Right.
His right. brother sometimes got involved in that, other church leaders. Mm-hmm. Indeed, were involved in that. And it became this kind of back and forth where she would assert herself and then he would try to control her. So mm-hmm. many people, including myself at times, wonder why she stuck it out with him.
Yeah.
What did you discover that was either illuminating about that or concerned you about that? Why do you think that was? Because I understand the culture and context of the times, but she was pretty radical.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I really struggle, honestly, with that, as you've alluded, and I'm sure many women do. It really bothers me almost to the core when I think about it, because I have so much respect and admiration for her, for who she was. And she wasn't afraid of questioning him on his teachings and preachings on polygamy. Even I know one time when he was preaching a sermon and he said, "The worst evil is in your home." You know, that was like a quote, almost direct quote from him. And everybody thought he was talking about Emma, and she was really offended by this. And she felt like, well, this is really unjust. You basically just told everybody, the worst evil is in your home. And so she challenged him on it. And she said, you need to apologize publicly to people about what you said. And so he did. He did. I mean, here she is, strong, defending herself. You know, this is unjust. Do it. And even, you know, I remember there, and it was about 1843. It was about a year before he died. She was really struggling with that, the thing with polygamy, you know, and she felt like, you know, it was just really bad. Well, then he has this revelation that it doesn't matter if the wife even gives consent. It's still going to happen anyway, you know, and she was just livid about it. And yet she went along with it. It was like a 2 or 3 month period. And she said, okay, if you're going to do this, let me at least pick who your wives are going to be. And she picked two sets of sisters. So she actually, in this 2 or 3 month period, picked 4 of his wives. We think that she probably knew about 7 of them, but different accounts tell him, you know, say that he had, you know, 27 or 48 or even 84 plural wives, some of them very young, you know, definitely lots of accounts. There's one account of a 14-year-old girl. And, you know, you can't imagine that she, even for this short period, she went along with it. And then, you know, she came back from this trip and she was just struggling with it so much. And I think one of the reasons, it seems like, I mean, there's lots of reasons, and there didn't have to be any reasons. It's just horrible. But one of the reasons too is that Julia, her daughter, was turning 13. And that's about the time that these men are starting to look around in their community for who's going to be, you know, the next plural wife for somebody. And she really was protecting Julia, I feel like, at that time. And so she, after about 2 or 3 months, she said, no, it's not going to happen again. I changed my mind. We're not going to do it. And the interesting thing is that from about that time, it was about November, I think, 1843, he still condoned it in the church, and he still authorized other people to do it, but he never took any more wives after that time, which I find interesting. Again, it's not black and white, and that doesn't redeem him in my eyes, and it's not crystal clear, but it shows her influence on him, and it shows the struggle in their marriage. And the thing that I keep coming back to, why did she stay? You know, and why did she stay? And especially right now, it's so complicated for me, because here we are in the Me Too era, you know? I mean, all of this stuff nationally is coming out. And this week, you know, for your listeners, this is being recorded on the week that we're talking about Brett Kavanaugh in the Supreme Court. And we're listening to the testimonies of Dr. Ford. And here we are 150 years later, and we're still asking ourselves, do we really trust that these women's story is true? Yeah. You know, do we really believe it? You know, and here we are, my movement, we denied it, right? For years and years and years. And I think even members of my congregation, my home congregation, to this day deny it. They don't think that he was a polygamist. And I just struggle with that. And I know she struggled with that. And privately, as you said, it was one of the biggest problems in their marriage. So why did she stick to it? I think I don't know. And I can't justify some of her thinking there. Some of it, I think, might do with it. I think she really, at her core, she really believed Joseph Smith was a prophet and that he spoke to God. I really think she believed that. And I really think that that level of certainty, I think, can do strange things to the psyche. I really think it can. And especially in a marriage context and when there's so much at stake. And, you know, she went from a very well-educated home life to poverty many times, most of her life with Joseph, to the elevated role, the number one female figure in a religious movement in a city of 15,000 people in Nauvoo that rivaled Chicago at the time.
They had political poverty, power as well.
They had political power, and Joseph was thinking of running for president. I mean, she could have been our first lady, you know, had he not been killed, maybe. I mean, he might not have won, but So she had this huge amount of power and status, although you would never really see that in the way she lived her life. And then back to poverty again and running for her life and having to flee Nauvoo and having people following her and threatening to burn down her mansion house with her and the children in it. And, you know, I mean, so the emotional ups and downs of this woman in her lifetime really boggle my mind. And why did she stick to it? I don't know. I really don't know. I think she loved her husband. That is clear in their writings. You know, when they write to each other, if you read their letters, they loved each other. And I'm not sure that she did threaten. I do remember that she threatened to divorce him, you know, when she came back finally from this trip and she said, we can't do this anymore. And he did stop. He continued to authorize other people to do it, I think, as I mentioned, but he didn't take any new wives. And so I think she had this push and pull with him. You know, she was very devout and she had a very strong belief in God and she believed he was a prophet and she loved her church, but she hated this part of it. And I don't know. It really does haunt me. That's probably the one thing in her story that I struggle with the most. And I even almost find myself a little resentful, I'm angry at her sometimes. I find myself thinking, why are you there? But then I look, even in our modern day, you know, women and men, why do they stay in abusive situations? Why do they do that? You know, children, family, finances. She had no means of financial support outside of Joseph because the properties hadn't been given over to her until right towards the end. And she was smart enough, again, this business mind in her. She wrote in this letter and said, should something happen to you, I need to have control of some properties for myself and the well-being of our children. You know, but before that, she had nothing. She had so many skills and so many people she could depend on, but she didn't have financial support for her four children. And I know that that's an issue today with women in situations where they feel like they can't get out financially. They don't have the support or they don't want to break the relationship between the fathers and their children. I think some of that is universal. I don't know. It's difficult. I really struggle with that.
So after Joseph was killed, you mentioned earlier that Emma did remarry and she also engaged in a battle with Brigham Young for the rest of her life. That was painful spiritually as well as economically.
Yeah.
On her. Let's talk a little bit about that period of her life.
Yeah, she really fled Nauvoo for her life after Joseph was killed. And the mobs, you know, that had come, and there was this really clear distinction of power between Brigham Young. There was actually 15 different splinter groups eventually of people saying, I'm going to go this way or that way or the other way, Lyman White and Sidney Rigdon and all these different members of the church, even some family members that pulled people in different directions. And she was very adamant about not going with Brigham Young. There's this great passage I would like to read that is so indicative, I think, of the time. She says, a trusted member of the church waited upon, this is Joseph Smith III, I'm sorry, writing the history of his life, and this is a little paragraph he writes about that time period. A trusted member of the church, so this is after Joseph has been killed, and member of the church would be there, it was all one group at this point, waited upon mother to ascertain what her feelings were in reference to following the church west. She informed him that she thought she would not go. The elder finally stated to her that it had been decided to offer her an opportunity to go, and that if she refused, it was, quote, decided to make her so poor that she would be glad to beg pardon of the 12 and follow them, end quote. Mm-hmm. So you really get this sense that she was being held in this position where she had to choose her livelihood and her safety of her children or following her inner feelings of not wanting to go with Brigham Young and the group that was going west. And I can't imagine that decision that she had to make. But she was facing poverty again, right? And she was facing physical threats of violence by staying, but she still stayed. Again, this is her tenacity. I just am amazed by that. I think a lot of it had to do with the issue of polygamy. I know that that was one of the leadership styles that went west, as it did to many of the other 15 groups that splintered off. And she was so opposed to that, that she just could not go with them. But I also think that at this time, a lot of the leaders of the church were trying to get a hold of his, of Joseph's holdings and the properties and the farm and, you know, the church buildings. And she lost, they lost as a family so much. There's, accounts of her that when he died, you know, he was so much in debt and the church was so much in debt, and the two were so connected at that time, the debt of the church and the debt of their family, that they were so much property was seized. And I think it was something like $125 was given to her annually to support her and her family from the, you know, the benefit of all the properties that they had after all the debt had been paid. That's what her family got. And it was just nothing compared to what they had had. And luckily she was smart enough, like I said before, to have Joseph transfer over some of the properties to her and the children there towards the end. Otherwise she really would have had nothing. But there's even an account of her, I think it might have been 2 years after, I think it was 1847. She had still not come back to Nauvoo. She was living somewhere else. And there was this account of a man who had been staying at the Mansion House and just decided he was going to break down the Mansion House and take all of the pieces with him west, because he claimed that it was his house, and out west, I think to California or something, and just rebuild with all the supplies from the Mansion House. And so she had to come back, 3 days journey, came back and went in front of the courts and said, you know, this is my home. We have lived here. I was run out of town. This man is stealing my property. You know, she had to fight again for her, what was hers. And she won. She won it. And then they stayed there. The family stayed there then after that. So she was able to preserve it. But this is the type of stuff she was fighting against, is this powerful, you know, men leaders in the church trying to take over the property and the titles to land and stuff that had been in the church property or in Joseph and her, Joseph's name. And so it was this real struggle. I think it wasn't just theological. I think it was also physical, tangible, the means to support my family. And it was something that she couldn't just submit to. I think that's a real theme with Emma, is that she just, no matter what was going on, is she just would not submit if it was against her moral or ethical values, except for a few times. Again, she's a complicated figure.
Anyway, as we all are, I think.
And, right, yeah. Right.
But we forget that when we begin to talk about figures who seem larger than life in our story, that they too were human beings with all of the different aspects, folly and wisdom that we all kind of display at different times. So as you researched her more, learned more about her, being female, being in a restoration tradition, a denomination that went from a patriarchal system to a system of equality with gender ministry. What was formative for you? You are a minister in this tradition. What was formative for you that you've carried forward in your own ministry that kind of stems from Emma and her story?
Yeah, I think for me, the biggest thing that has been formative for me is seeing this woman, this strong woman who against all odds was so tenacious in her beliefs. And she was very devout, very strong believer in the church and in her children. But she was this loving, compassionate, funny, amazing woman who had such strong moral character that she pushed against. And being a woman growing up in a time that was better for women, my generation had it better than the generations before me, but I was looking for strong women. You know, my mother was a very strong woman. She was very passionate, very intelligent, a very smart woman. And I was looking for these other female role models at a time when I was trying to figure out what kind of woman I was going to be. And Emma's story is so inspiring for young women, but also young religious women, because we don't have examples of strong religious women. We don't have enough. We don't have enough examples of strong religious women who are also sassy and bold and smart and physically capable and building log cabins and taking care of sick people and riding across, you know, in a wagon with children. And there's a lot of stories of religious women knowing the scriptures and being there on Sunday at potluck and playing the piano. And those are wonderful stories too. Those are wonderful. I'm not trying to downplay that, but this pairing of ferociously loving your children and your family and God and your church and doing that unapologetically and standing up to injustice when you see it and fighting for your rights at a time when it wasn't common for women to stand up or go to court and fight for their rights and their property and speaking truth to sexual power, you know, that is really damaging to generations of young women, it's inspiring to me, is very formative for me. I really, latched on to Emma's story and her, strengths, I think, at a time in my life when I was in my 20s, when I was trying to figure out who I was going to be. And she inspired me and absolutely formed me in my discipleship. I think going to Nauvoo and experiencing for me that repression of women's power, it led me to my focus on my master's thesis and my peace studies experience. To really understanding the role of women in our church and the role of women in society and where we stand and who we can become. And I think her story, for me at least, really helped launch me in that direction and informed me. And one of the things I like to do now in my own congregation is I like to highlight some of the things that women do, not in really in your face kind of ways, but for prayer for peace, during prayer for peace, or during the disciples' generous response or something, I'll sometimes share the story about different women and what they've done and their lives, and whether it's as powerful as Emma's or as, you know, subtle as just, you know, the elderly woman that played the piano in my congregation growing up or whatever, but just telling these stories. Her life has made it possible for me to articulate a little bit more how important it is for us to do that.
Which is very much the purpose and the focus as we listen to this, preparing for the celebration of All Saints Day. That's in the church, the telling of the story, allowing the story to shape and form us in who we are in our discipleship and in our spiritual journey. So if we had saints in Community of Christ, Christy,
yeah.
Who would Emma be the patron saint of? That's terrible grammar, but that's the best way to phrase it.
Yeah, that is, it's such a great one. The two that kind of stand out for me are the sick, because she always had so many people in her home that she would care for. There's stories I know of that first year in, Commerce, it was called Commerce back then, but when they were in Nauvoo. And there was a malaria outbreak and there were just families scattered on her lawn, and she actually moved out into a tent with her family so she could take care of people in her home that were sick. And there's just, when you read her letters, there's just, she's always writing about people that are sick and this person's recovering from an illness and this person is now feeling worse, or this person passed away, or, you know, and it's just a part of her life. And year after year, you know, you'll read about her talking about the cholera epidemic this year wasn't as bad as last year. And we're hoping that the fever this year is better. And there's just, sickness is just such a part of her daily experience. And she's so concerned about it. And she worked so hard to heal people and bless people and comfort people. So to me, I think the patron saint of the sick, I think, would be one of the things that stands out for Emma. It's probably not the most obvious choice because she's so known for so many different things. But when you really listen to her own words, that's what she's thinking about, and that's what she's caring about, and that's what she's doing every day. And then the other one is her children. I think the patron, possibly the patron saint of children, because she, again, in her letters, you know, she talks so much about my blessed children, and I want all my children. I can't wait to see all my children back together again. She's always longing for the time when they were all together. And these are children that are in their, you know, 30s and 40s and, you know, 50s sometimes. And she's got her grandchildren at times are living with her, and her nieces and her nephews. And she's always wanting her children and her family just to be all together again with her. And it's like this longing. And I wonder sometimes if that's part of that separation that she had with Joseph over their relationship. And even with Vitamin, Major Vitamin, he would often leave for long trips to go panning for gold in California or whatever. And she was longing for this reunited family, sense of family. And so for me, I think I can't separate the image of Emma. And again, maybe this goes back to my childhood, but of her crossing that river with her children around her. And when she gets there, within a year, she's taking care of these sick masses of sick people. And I think for me, that's what it is. It might be different for other people, but the sick and the children, that was her life. And that's what she thought the most about and cared the most about. And don't we all just need more patron saints for sick people and children? You know,
do.
if everyone would just care about those populations more, the world would be a better place. So that's it for me.
Well, I think that's it, Christy, with our modern day focus on 165, when we talk about the caring for the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
So that's what we're doing. Yeah. So we are about at the end of our time. So do you have any last observations you'd like to share with us about Emma, or closing thoughts about her?
Yeah, I think for me, just to kind of sum up Emma, she really influenced Joseph Smith Jr. and the early church in a way from the very beginning of the movement. And it would have been a different church without her. And I really want us to reclaim that, or maybe your audience to hear that they're coming from a tradition, and we are coming from a tradition, and we are all part of this tradition that was formed by her and the interactions she had with Joseph. And she was such a strong supporter of Joseph when she felt like he was on the right path, but then such a loud voice of dissent when she thought that he wasn't, which is amazing for the time and situation. And that she stood up for the welfare of children and for women in the community, really forcibly opposing polygamy, except for, again, that brief period. But really constantly and fed that to her children, and was sort of this equal rights activist before equal rights was even in the public eye. She was just courageous and standing against these forces of patriarchy and struggling, you know, with what that meant for her in her personal life. And I just wonder how the early church would have been different, and subsequent generations would have been different, if Emma had not been the strong and passionate and kind and intelligent woman that she was. Like if Joseph had married anyone else, the movement would be so different. And truly, I wonder if our reorganization would have come to being. I truly wonder that. And so for me, I guess just my last observations is just so much gratitude to her and so much admiration, and also that tension. You know, it's okay for us to feel tension with our idols, and it's okay. Here we are talking about her as a saint, and yet she enabled to some level, you know, the horrors that happened in Nauvoo. And we have to face that. We have to let people be human too. They are our saints, but they are also human, and they struggle. And truly, I feel like our movement would not be what it was without her. I think that's probably my last observation, and just absolute gratitude for her, for everything she's given me in my life.
Well, I want to thank you, Christy, for being our guest today. As we look to All Saints Day and what that means in the life of the church, you've given us some depth to better understand a large figure in our restoration story and tradition, and taken her from being kind of one-dimensional images and story that we tell to really being an underpinning of who we are and contributor to the DNA of who Community of Christ is today.
Again,
we've been chatting with Christy Scoresmith, and we appreciate the time that you've taken to help us better understand Emma Smith. So for all of our listeners, thank you. I will share that gratitude with you. And for listeners, thank you for listening in today on Common Grounds, part of the Project Zion podcast. I'm Karen Peter. We've been with Christy Scoresmith. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.